Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. Methamphetamine made its way onto the drug scene in the early 1990s. This drug is just as easy as it is dangerous to make. One man, Dustin Honkin, would become a minor drug kingpin in Iowa by using his uncanny chemistry knowledge to make a potent product that addicts craved. His empire ran smooth until he was arrested for trafficking and his dealers turned on him. Dustin and his girlfriend Angela Johnson would have their revenge. Okay, on to the show. Angela Johnson and Dustin Honkin park their car blocks away from their intended destination. They grabbed their instruments of intimidation and made their way to the home of Lori Duncan. Lori, her boyfriend Greg Nicholson, and her two daughters, 10-year-old Candace and 6-year-old Amber, weren't expecting any visitors on the night of July 24, 1993. They heard a knock at the door. Lori opened the door to see Angela, who pretended to be a cosmetic salesperson who needed to borrow her phone. As Lori opened her door to welcome Angela inside, Dustin rushed in and pushed Greg Nicholson against the wall. Lori Duncan began to yell at Dustin to let him go. Angela ushered Lori and her children into a separate room while Dustin tied Greg to a dining room chair. He pulled a camera out of the canvas bag he brought with him and began filming Greg. He demanded Greg recant the story he told police into the camera. Greg was due to testify the next day about Dustin's role as a methamphetamine supplier. He initially refused to cooperate, but then Dustin pulled out a small pistol and pointed it at him. He offered the statement to the camera, and Dustin stopped recording. He got up to release Greg from the chair, but instead, pistol whipped him, causing him to fall to the ground. Lori heard a thud and tried to rush past Angela. Angela told her to sit still, or the girls, who were already crying and holding on to their mother in fear, were next. Lori wrapped her arms around her daughters and sat there listening to her live-in boyfriend moaning and grunting. The girls began screaming and crying louder than before. Dustin ran into the room, bloody, and told Angela to shut them up. Lori attempted to push past them, but Dustin knocked her to the ground and wrapped a rope around her neck. He ordered Angela to take care of her, and Angela straddled her and strangled her to death in front of her daughters. Dustin had strangled Greg and helped Angela move Lori's body to the front of the house. They looked at each other, as if silently asking what to do with the girls. They both walked towards the girls and strangled them to death. To ensure everyone was dead, Dustin shot each one of the victims in the back of the head. They then ran back to the car, drove it to the house, and loaded the bodies in the trunk. They drove down Cerro Gordo County Road, where Dustin dug a shallow grave in a wooded area. He and Angela spent the next hour burying the bodies. On the afternoon of July 26, Lori's mother, Margie Milbraith, drove past her daughter's home on at least two occasions. She found it odd that both cars were still in the driveway and hadn't moved in the few hours that had elapsed between each visit. Her motherly intuition told her something was not right when she passed by the home again after work. She parked her car at her home that was only a few blocks down the road and knocked on the door. There was no answer. She contacted the landlord who allowed her to enter the property. She quickly looked around the home and noticed the remnants of dinner from the night before were still on the table. Lori ran a tight ship and day-old food would not have been left out on the table. Her daughter's house was messier than she was used to. Sure, with two active children, it's hard to keep a tidy home, but the mess on the table and the rest of the house set alarm bells off in Margie's head. She immediately headed to the Mason City Police Department to file a missing persons report for Lori and the girls. Dustin Lee Honkin, a native of Britt, Iowa, began to notice how popular a new drug hitting the streets of Arizona had become. He excelled in chemistry at the local community college and began to realize that his knowledge would help him in avoiding the mistakes other meth labs were experiencing, namely the explosions. He enlisted the help of his brother, Jeff Honkin, and best friend Timothy Cutcomp, to help him finance and cook the addicting drug. During his time in Iowa, he had become acquainted with two well-known drug dealers, Greg Nicholson and Terry DeGuess. The plan was to have Dustin send the product from his home base in Arizona to Greg and Terry in Mason City. It was 1993, and Terry was ending his relationship with his girlfriend, Angela Johnson. Having heard of the breakup, Dustin then pursued a relationship with Angela, quickly bringing her into his growing meth empire. When Angela stepped in, she assumed a large role, much to the chagrin of everyone that worked with Dustin. In early March of 1993, local authorities began investigating Greg Nicholson and his probable ties to trafficking meth in Mason City. Oblivious in Arizona, Dustin continued manufacturing. Greg's house was eventually raided, and he's offered a deal if he turns on his supplier. The authorities asked Greg to contact Dustin and set up a meeting for March 21, 1993. Dustin agreed to the meeting and arrived at Greg's residence in Mason City to discuss future supplies and to collect money Greg owed him for past distributions. Once the money was exchanged, officers rushed in and arrested Dustin and Timothy. Dustin was charged with state drug offenses but quickly made bail and returned to Tempe, Arizona. Dustin relocated to Mason City while awaiting his trial and sentencing. In April of 1993, Greg testified before a grand jury that the drugs were indeed manufactured in Arizona and then sent to him to sell in Iowa. The grand jury indicted Dustin for conspiracy to manufacture methamphetamine, a federal drug charge which carried a heftier sentence than the state charges he initially received. The evidence against him was irrefutable, and Dustin opted to plead guilty to all of the charges against him. The court accepted his plea and scheduled his sentencing hearing for July 30, 1993. He was able to post bond and began his plot for clearing his name and having the charges dropped against him. Dustin spent the next 2 months searching for Greg by driving around town and asking mutual friends, usually with Angela by his side. On July 3, 1993, a now pregnant Angela applied for a handgun permit for which she was later granted. On July 7th, she purchased a 9mm handgun. If there was any confusion as to what Dustin was really planning to do when he found Greg, that was cleared up with the purchase of that handgun. Meanwhile, Greg and Lori struck up a romantic relationship, which is how he came to be with Lori and her daughters in her home on that fateful night. Greg heard through mutual acquaintances that Dustin was looking for him, and he wanted Lori to keep a low profile. Eventually, Dustin was tipped off to Greg's location and discussed the plan with Angela. On the night of July 24th, the pair left Angela's daughter from a previous relationship with her friend, Christy Gobbets. Christy was used to the routine by now. Angela had left her child with her on several occasions while she and Dustin borrowed Christy's car and searched the city for Greg Nicholson. Their searches typically ended around midnight, but that didn't happen. Their searches typically ended around midnight, but they didn't return to pick up her child until 5 a.m. the following day. One problem for Dustin had been eliminated. Lori and the girls were just collateral. On July 30th, 1993, Dustin arrived to a sentencing hearing with the VHS tape in hand. He gave it to his lawyer and told him he was no longer pleading guilty to the charges. The contents of the VHS show Greg contradicting the testimony he gave to the grand jury in April. Dustin also shared with his attorney that word around town was that Greg had skipped town. Dustin entered a plea of not guilty, and a trial date would soon be scheduled. He spent the next few months under investigation for drug trafficking. Although authorities could not locate Greg Nicholson, they issued warrants for his arrest and continued their search into his whereabouts. Dustin feared that his other dealer and Angela's ex-boyfriend, Terry, would flip on him like Greg did. He conferred with Tim and shared his concern that Terry had been subpoenaed by the grand jury, though he had no definitive proof. Dustin had every right to his suspicions, as Terry had been caught by police with meth and agreed to flip on Dustin in order to avoid jail time. Despite not knowing about Terry's testimony for sure, Dustin and Angela discussed silencing Terry for good. On Friday, November 5th, Angela called Terry's mother, Joanne, and asked her to pass along a message. that she wanted to meet up with Terry at her job, the Mason City Country Club. Terry's daughter was already at her grandparents' house but returned home to Terry shortly after the call. When Terry decided he was going to meet up with Angela, he brought 10-year-old Ashley back to his parents' home. He promised her that he would return by midnight to pick her up, and he gave her permission to watch TV until he returned. Terry traveled to the country club. He figured that Angela wanted to talk about getting back together, and since his feelings for her still lingered, he hoped for a reconciliation. When he arrived at the country club, Angela suggested they head to a rural farm nearby for some more privacy. Terry agreed, and when they arrived, he exited the car. He was attacked from behind by Dustin, who wielded a baseball bat, and was savagely beaten until he collapsed to the floor. Dustin then forced Terry to his knees and riddled his body with bullets, the final shot going into the back of his head. Terry's mother encouraged her granddaughter to get some rest. It was well past midnight, and her son had not shown up as promised. The household woke the next day with no word from Terry, which was unusual. When Joanne called Angela to find out where he was, Angela claimed he stood her up and never showed. Several days would pass before Terry was reported missing. When authorities discovered Angela might be the last person to see him, they were interested in speaking with her. Police picked up Angela and began asking her about Terry and their meetup. Angela admitted she had called Joanne's home looking for Terry and that she wanted to talk to them about their relationship, but she never got the chance to because he didn't show up. She figured he had second thoughts and decided not to come. She was permitted to leave after her questioning, and she began changing her story depending on who she was talking to. To some people, she would deny ever seeing him. To others, she would say that they had a conversation and she returned to work. His disappearance would remain unsolved for several years. Angela welcomed her child with Dustin Honkin in 1994. The pending court date was moved several times while police attempted to find the two key witnesses to Dustin's crimes. Dustin was calm because he knew it would be impossible to find them. However, things began to fall apart one wintry day in 1994. Christy was cleaning the house she shared with the couple when she found a 9mm handgun with a silencer stashed in a bag inside of her closet. She had children of her own, and the gun could have easily been found by anyone. She was furious and called Angela. Angela tried to calm Christy down, saying Dustin would be by to pick up the gun. Dustin arrived shortly after the phone call and retrieved the gun. He asked Timothy for assistance in destroying it. Timothy used a blowtorch to melt the gun and serial number. When the gun was in pieces, they traveled around Mason City, discarding individual pieces on rural roads. Dustin felt confident enough about skating the charges that he resumed his methamphetamine production. He needed a dealer he could trust, one who wouldn't flip on him. He thought he found that in Dan Cobine, but he needed those charges to disappear, so he knew for sure the eyes of the law would be off of him. On March 21, 1995, Dustin got his wish. The federal charges against him were formally dropped due to the prosecution's inability to locate the two main witnesses. For Dustin, that was the green light he needed to approach Dan Cobine with the offer. He asked Angela to be present for their first meeting, as he wouldn't move forward without her approval. When the first meeting took place, Angela nodded in approval. Shortly after that meeting, Dan was approached by law enforcement, who asked him to help with their investigation. He agreed without hesitation. Dustin spent the remainder of the year gathering supplies to set up his new meth lab. By early 1996, the lab was ready to go. He called Dan and told him that the operation would be ready by February. Dan then called his handlers to give them an update on the timeline. Police now had the information they needed to move forward with a raid on Dustin's apartment.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
On February 7th, 1996, Dustin's house was raided by law enforcement. They found exactly what they were looking for and took into evidence a meth lab, chemicals, and notes on how to cook the drugs. Another interesting piece of recorded evidence were books on how to bind and gag prisoners. He and Timothy were arrested again and charged with conspiring to manufacture and distribute methamphetamine, spanning from the years 1992 until 1996. In June of 1996, a storage shed rented by Dustin was also seized, where more supplies and chemicals were found, adding to the surefire case against him. Dustin knew he had been betrayed by Dan, so he began formulating plans with Angela about murdering Dan Cobine and other law enforcement officers. He shared their plans with Timothy, but also shared that he was worried about Angela getting involved. Upon hearing the plan, Timothy wanted nothing to do with it. He approached authorities and agreed to comply for a reduced sentence. As a result, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison and points the finger at Dustin for being responsible for the disappearance of Greg, Lori, Candace, Amber, and Terry. Upon the court hearing Timothy's testimony, Dustin's bond was revoked and he was detained at Woodbury County Jail in Sioux City, Iowa. Dustin couldn't help but show off in the county jail and admitted to several fellow inmates that he murdered 5 people several years earlier. He also worked on plans to murder Timothy Cutcomp and provided his personal information to a prisoner who he would contract to murder Timothy. This prisoner would ultimately tell authorities what he knew about Dustin's murder plot. Dustin and a fellow inmate began plotting their escape from the county jail. They managed to break a hole in the wall and keep it hidden until Dustin could coordinate with Angela. He asked her to bring a hacksaw and a rope that would be passed through the wall. His plan would be thwarted when correctional officers found the hole. With his plans for escaping and murder ended, Dustin opted to plead guilty to 1 count of conspiracy and 1 count of manufacturing. Police searched the properties he was associated with in an attempt to find the 5 missing people. In February of 1998, Dustin was sentenced to 24 years in prison, while Angela remained free. One by one, the dominoes were collapsing all around her. In 2000, Christy decided to offer her cooperation to authorities who were still searching for the 5 missing people, now presumed dead. She told them about the searches that Angela and Dustin conducted almost every week searching for Greg. She recalled them coming home early in the morning and whispering about something. She also shared how she found a gun and a silencer in her home and that Angela quickly told her to forget what she found. There was enough circumstantial evidence to arrest and indict Angela Johnson for the murders of Greg Nicholson, Lori Duncan, her 2 daughters, and Terry DeGuess. She was held without bond and remanded to Benton County Jail. While imprisoned, she met and acquainted herself with Robert McNeese. Robert was serving a life sentence and began to chat with Angela about her case. Unbeknownst to Angela, Robert was a well-known jailhouse informant. He told her he could help her find a lifer who would confess to the crimes. He said he had ties to the mob and would wield his connections to get whatever he wanted. Angela jumped at the opportunity. She asked Robert what he needed from her to move forward with the plan. He told her that in order for the confession to be believable, he needed all of the details of the crime, and if she knew where the bodies were buried, that would further prove that she had nothing to do with the murders. Angela detailed the murders to Robert and drew a map of where the 5 bodies were located. She notated the surrounding area so that the prisoner could be as descriptive as possible. Armed with the drawings and details, Robert turned his information over to authorities. On October 13, 2000, authorities discovered the bodies of Greg Nicholson and the Duncans in 1 shallow grave. Autopsies revealed that Lori and Greg had been bound, gagged, and shot multiple times. The girls had a single gunshot wound to the back of their heads. A month later, Terry's body would be found only a few miles away, face down, in a shallow grave. Pieces of his skull had to be carefully collected, as they were so fragmented and scattered from the beating and multiple gunshot wounds he sustained. Angela and Dustin maintained communication, and she informed him that she had been duped by Robert. Dustin was transferred to a penitentiary in Colorado, but continued plotting how he was going to get out of this mess. He knew that several murder charges would be filed against him, and the only way to prevent the trial from moving forward would be to murder everyone. He told a fellow inmate that if he was tried for the murders, he would call him and other inmates, or as he called them, associates, to be placed on his witness list. When they would arrive at the courthouse to testify, they could overpower the bailiff and other officers, killing them all and escaping. While on the run, he would murder any witnesses and the prosecutor. Dustin and his associates began practicing ways to remove their handcuffs without keys, as well as close-quarter combat when surrounded by armed escorts. Dustin was preparing for the battle of his life. His prediction of being charged with the murders would be realized in August of 2001, when he and Angela were charged in the 5 homicides. Because they were given a federal charge, they qualified for the death penalty. In October of 2002, Dustin and Angela pled not guilty to the charges. Dustin's trial began in September 2004. Because of his previous death threats and escape attempts, he was heavily shackled and had to wear a stun gun belt. The evidence against him was strong, and a jury found him guilty on all 5 counts in October of 2004. He was sentenced to death in October 2005. Angela's trial began in May 2005, and almost as quickly as it started, it was over. She was found guilty of all 5 murders, and despite reservations held by her trial judge, she received her death sentence in December of that same year. She was now the first woman to be sentenced to death in a federal case since 1953. The bodies of all 5 victims were returned to their families after the trials concluded. The judge initially denied requests to return the remains, as they were considered evidence in both trials. They were placed to rest in quiet ceremonies with close friends and family in attendance. Dustin and Angela continued to appeal their death sentences, but were issued firm denials in 2008. The following year, Angela requested a new trial, or that her death sentence be vacated for a number of reasons, including ineffective assistance of counsel. Angela argued that they failed to disclose her mental illness, which would have possibly impacted the jury's decision to issue the death penalty. In March of 2011, she was brought before U.S. District Court Judge Mark Bennett for a hearing on her sentencing. He would issue his ruling a year later, in March of 2012. Where he vacated her death sentence and ruled that she would be sentenced to a life of imprisonment. To support his ruling, he stated, quote, "There is a reasonable probability that had her trial counsel not performed efficiently, the outcome of Johnson's mitigation phase would have been different." He agreed with the defense counsel that had the jury heard about her mental illness, as well as interviews with psychiatrists, that she would have likely been spared the death penalty. He understood how his ruling would hurt the families of the victims, and made it a point to let them know that he did not make the decision lightly. He wrote to them directly in the last pages of his ruling saying, quote, "My heart does go out to them. Nevertheless, I believe that I have done my duty in light of what is required by the Constitution, the foundational document of our nation's enduring freedoms, including the right not to be put to death when trial counsel's performance was so grossly constitutionally inadequate." Terry DeGuess's sister, Brenda Stone, told AP reporters that she was disappointed in the ruling, but that if the prosecutors in the case could appeal the case, then they should. If they chose not to, then she wanted to avoid another trial, which would inevitably cause grief to the surviving family members. She stated in part, "I don't think anybody could ever imagine what it's been like for us. The manner that he and the others were killed is enough terror to keep us thinking about it for the rest of our lives. And this brings it more to the limelight. Time heals. It really does. If you cannot think about it so much, life seems to be a lot better." Prosecutors declined to take the case any further, and Angela's death sentence was converted to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole in December of 2014. She is currently housed in the Federal Correctional Institution in Waseca, Minnesota. Dustin Honkin is serving out his sentence in the United States Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. He continues to deny his role in the murders and only feels remorse for getting into drugs and not being a father to his 2 children. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and positively review the show on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request or general suggestion, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. Custom music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams. Check him out on Twitter @WeTalkOfDreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Research assistant, content editing, and writing assistance for the show was provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering was provided by Ches Gray, who manages Ches Gray Music.